Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Another week reaches its halfway point. The 29th day of April, 2009. One day left in April. The 100th day of the Obama administration. All of those things. Yes, indeed, and more. Hump day downhill to Friday. And, of course, here, you know, not just those things. But brothers and sisters, brethren and sistren, it is Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Welcome to the Cathedral of Common Sense. I am Brother Bishop Bob Kincaid. Choirmaster, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen. Let me hear you say, praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man. Don't you know, he should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD. Just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah. Solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity, yeah. Whoever said religion should be free?
Talking about.
Jesus.
I can't hear you.
Jesus.
I still can't hear you.
Jesus
Christ our Lord. Do you know His name?
Hallelujah.
Have you seen His glory? Have you felt the warming comfort of His precious love? Praise Jesus. Praise His holy name. Praise His blessed spirit. Praise His everlasting love. Jesus Christ our Lord. Listen to me now.
Hallelujah, brethren and sistren. Come on down the blood-red carpet and lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of common sense a-flowing through your mortal being. Ha! Ha! Shimmily spots, Ned, breath, little spots, shimmeling dong, I love you. It is Prayer Meeting Wednesday here on the Horn, America's liberal voice. And let's get started with some... Look, there's funny wingnuttery, and there's ignorant wingnuttery, And then there's plain old garden variety hateful wing nuttery. I got that version for you this evening in the form of Representative Virginia Fox.
I also would like to point out that there was a bill, the hate crimes bill that's called the Matthew Shepard bill, is named after a very unfortunate incident that happened where a young man was killed. But we know that young man was killed in the commitment of a robbery. It wasn't because he was gay. The bill was named for him. The hate crimes bill was named for him. But it's really a hoax that continues to be used as an excuse for passing these bills.
Gentlemen, to you.
In just a moment. I also want to point out.
That's right. In Wingnut Land, the murder of the slaughter of Matthew Shepard is a hoax. He wasn't really crucified on a barbed wire fence. He wasn't really pistol whipped over 50 times until the side of his skull caved in. He wasn't really completely covered on his face in blood, save for the tracks of his tears. Matthew Shepard's murder in right-wing world, in the land of hate and bigotry, is a hoax. A hoax. A scam. A phony. Oh, yeah, a robbery did take place as North Carolina pig-licking Virginia Fox noted. It most assuredly did. But the robbery was planned. The evidence is out there. It has been adduced. It has been found to be fact. The murderers of Matthew Shepard were a couple of right-wing redneck monsters. Named Henderson and McKinney. Their girlfriends testified at the trial and the jury found their testimony to be credible. That Henderson and McKinney had plotted well in advance that they planned that they would rob and beat a gay man. They went to the Fireside Lounge in Laramie, Wyoming. Where they targeted Matthew Shepard. Offering Matthew Shepard a ride home from the bar. They took him out into the Wyoming countryside outside Laramie. And they did rob him. And they did crucify him on a barbed wire fence. They listened mercilessly and remorselessly as Matthew Shepard begged for his very life. Henderson and McKinney were both as sober as judges, as sober as preacher men, the whole time. They robbed him, but they murdered him. Because he was gay. And this vile, disgusting, verminous pile of excrescence that walks and talks and goes by the name of Virginia Fox says that naming a bill after Matthew Shepard
because of the brutal way in which he was slaughtered, that bill is predicated upon a hoax. Truly disgusting. Truly emblematic of the soulless nature of the Repig-Lickin' Party. Also emblematic of the Repig-Lickin' Party's abject stupidity. We're 3 days into the final week of April 2009, and we have had stupidity on parade. Michelle Bachmann declaring that carbon dioxide is really good for people. It's natural. Just like the collagen from little aborted Chinese infants that I rub into my face every day to keep from looking like the haggard old virago that I really am. Or Michelle Bachmann yesterday declaring that the last swine flu epidemic, coincidentally, it's just a coincidence, broke out during the presidency of Jimmy Carter in 1976, which happened in the presidency of Gerald Ford in 1975, but who's counting? And now today, Virginia Fox. This one ain't crazy like a fox. This one is stupid like a bag of homemade ignorant. Because you see, there's been a whole persistent outcry from the right wing over the hate crimes bill. What do we got? Let's see. Michelle Bachmann again.
I feel that this hate crime legislation could be considered the very definition of tyranny.
Really? Tyranny? You think? Tyranny?
Tyranny of, like, Hitler, Mussolini, Pol Pot? That kind of tyranny? George the Third? Tyranny?
Then there's Representative Greshman Barrett, a Repig-Lickin' from, of course, South Carolina.
This bill would inhibit religious freedom in all society. Oh, scary thought.
Yeah, if your religion is hate, I suppose it might. Or if your religion is based on committing crimes against people because of your hate. Then there's Representative Louis Gohmert.
God, you know, if I wrote down the name of a Repig-Lickin' congressman from Texas, and I said, and we're going to call him Louis Gohmert, the publisher would say, you're going to change the name, Bob. I mean, that's just not realistic. Louis Gohmert said, you think a pregnant mother does not deserve the protection of a homosexual? You think a military member doesn't deserve the protection of a transvestite?
Oh, wait a minute. I've got a story in the stack this evening about a military transgendered person, but that's for later. Then there's Representative Steve King from Iowa Way.
I, Mr. Speaker, oppose and I defy the logic of the people that would advocate for such legislation, the very idea we could divine what goes on in the heads of people when they commit crimes.
Yeah, we can't be doing that. That's just crazy talk. Who'd ever want to pass a law like that? Oh, wait a minute. We already did. 1968. The federal hate crimes law that enhances penalties for crimes that were based on race, religion, and national origin. You know, crimes that start out with, you dirty, fill in the racial or ethnic slur. I'm going to kill you. Well, you know, that guy does deserve to do extra time. It's bad enough to kill somebody, but to kill somebody for an accident of birth over which they had no control? See, that makes the crime worse. Now, if, on the other hand, there was a rash of brutal beatings and murders of people for being Repiglicans, why, these people would be screaming for a hate crimes law. Because they're being persecuted. Or let's say that somebody went around just beating the snot out of Baptists. Or beating the snot out of Presbyterians or Lutherans. Or all those groups. We're being persecuted for our religion's sake, just like Jesus told us we would. Josh, you got to pass a law. But not for gay people. Not for people who remain among the most vulnerable in our society. Not for them. Yeah, we've already got a law, but nobody's really clued the Repiglican Party in on that. All the new law does is add sexual orientation and gender identity to that list of protected groups, race, religion, national origin. It's a simple law. It's a tiny law. It's an easy law. It's a reasonable law, a rational law, a law whose time, oh God, whose time, well after the slaughter of Matthew Shepard, whose time has come. Among other things, it would allow local governments to get much-needed resources from the federal government to help defray the costs of the lengthy investigations that stem from these kinds of vicious crimes. You know, Steve King says he can't divine what goes on in the heads of people when they commit crimes. What about when they say what goes on in their heads when they commit crimes? What about Mr. Adkisson in Knoxville, Tennessee, who said he was going to slaughter liberals inside the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church because they were liberals, because they were Democrats, because they were gay? Or sympathetic thereto. Would the right wing actually have the nerve to look at us and say, nah, he gets a pass on all that. He's just another murderer. Really, this is the apotheosis of right wing Repiglican ignorance and hate muddled and melded together. Truly it is. Because, well, they're protecting the Klan. The conduct of the Repiglican Party with regard to this bill protects the Klan. The Klan. You know, when the Klan goes out with their hoods over their heads by the dark and still of the night, and they grab some unsuspecting, pathetic soul and leave him swinging in a tree, or sunken to the bottom of a river wrapped in chains, they don't do it because they're murderers. They do it because they are filled and suffused with the most venomous, toxic, and virulent hate of which the human race is capable. And these dirty, no good, increasingly irrelevant sons of bitches self-made, and daughters as well, are going to bat for the Klan. The answer's finally in. You heard the numbers listening to Mark Levine. You know that the Repiglican Party is down to 20-21% in the United States. That they are a contracting and concentrating the sickening, cancerous little core of right-wing ideologues suffused with a murderous rage against all things that ain't white. You know what they are. And hopefully they will concentrate and concentrate and concentrate. It's a tinier, tinier, tinier little knot until they're just a little greasy ball that we can roll between our hands and like a magician flicking nothing at the audience. Maybe, but not yet. No, they're still full of piss and vinegar. And they got enough in them. They got enough in them to stand on the floor of the House of Representatives where they exercise that most protected of all American speech. And slur a crucified boy. Damn them. Damn. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome. Oh. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, Gonzo, greetings, Bob. What's going on?
Hey, Spike.
And, you know, they have to protect the Klan because Pat Toomey's running for the Senate this year in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, his voters have to have protection to go to the polls. No one cramping on their style there.
Yeah, well, isn't he a grand dragon or illustrious wizard or noble potentate or some such?
And not to mention, you know, I can almost guarantee you his fan base will be like the guy in Pittsburgh who might kill a few cops because his fighting dog took a leak all over his mother's rug. I find it very interesting what is left of that 20%. And for years, I've always said, no matter what, each party has like a 20-25% fringe that'll never go away, and this is probably it right about here. I'd say they're about sinking to rock bottom at this point, what's left in the Republican Party. Because there was a guy in Easton, he's the city controller, and I always liked him because he was a big critic of the Republican mayor, how blunderous of a mayor he was, an embarrassment. And he would always ask me, oh, when are you going to become a Republican? 3 weeks ago, he became a Democrat, even though he's not up for re-election for 2 years, because he said his conscience, he couldn't stay a Republican anymore. You know, this is someone who in the 80s came from Lebanon to America, basically the locked-in Ronald Reagan crowd, and he's a Democrat now. So.
And see, the thing that bears mentioning here, Spike, is these are not what I just played. It's not extremist inside the Republican Party. The views of Virginia Fox, the views of Iowa's Steve King, the views of Louie Gohmert and Gretchen Barrett of South Carolina and Texas, their views are not extreme inside the Republican Party. Those are the mainstream views of the Republican Party in the United States. And you know what? People like Olympia Snow, people like Susan Collins, Republicans who consider themselves to have any shred, any teeny tiny shred of decency about them, need to understand that that's the face of their party. They're not.
You know, it's funny. You want to see how crazy I was. Just look at the commentators that are left. You know, remember when they used to be conservative commentators? As a liberal, this guy's got good points sometimes. Yeah, I like this guy.
Hey, remember William Buckley?
It's scary when
at least that guy came out and said pot should be legal.
It's scary when we've reached a point where now Pat Buchanan seems like a reasonable individual compared to what else is out there in the conservative world.
It makes me feel I see Pat Buchanan and I feel like, you know, and he said it just the other day. The Republican Party's got to come to grips with the fact that it is a concentrating, shrinking little white people's party.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at Pat Buchanan going, right on, brother. The hell's wrong with me?
Yeah. I mean, and I think even, look at it. The people that are left that are basically spewing the talking points is like Hannity, O'Reilly, you know, those two are certified Nimrods, in many other words I can't say. Savage, a.k.a. Wiener, the Wiener man.
Yeah, I was so proud of myself. I highlighted the Savage Wiener last night, And bare moments later, Olbermann was doing the same thing on his show. It's like some sort of liberal radar love thing going. I don't know. It's like there's a link.
Yeah.
No, there's not. Well. How can you walk past that kind of racism and not comment on it, Spike?
And that's literally what's become the mainstream of the Republican Party. With best of all, with Michael Steele running the show, because he spoke the same night Sarah Palin did. I think everyone who was on that night on TV, because of the big TV ratings, got a sweet gig. Other than maybe Sarah Palin, who got sent back to her job of not running the state of Alaska. I can't believe how crazy it's become. I mean, you know, Spector isn't exactly a uber liberal. I mean, maybe compared to the nuts in that party, he looks awfully liberal. Compared to the other Democrat senator on some issues, he's very liberal. I guess there's the upside for us as Democrats in Pennsylvania. Hey, someone who believes in women's choices is now a Democratic senator from Pennsylvania. I'm a cynic, and I'm someone who has a dark sense of humor. So in a way, I'm enjoying watching it all just go to shambles now. You know, I have a lot of anger and animosity somewhat towards the right, and especially their issues on healthcare in this country. So long before my father passed, that just kind of reaffirmed my belief in just overall the profitable greed machine that, for the most part, runs the healthcare system. I'm lucky my family doctor is actually one of the more reasonable. He believes in the Dalai Lama and, you know, believes in crazy things like no one in America should make more than $1 million a year. You only need two cars and two houses at best. You know, that allowing unlimited greed is what brought us down the road we're in. So hang on to
that one, Spike.
The specialists were totaled D-bags, basically, you know, given the news of my father. And I mean, it's just no concern. Like, when he went to the hospital the night he passed, the one specialist was like, yeah, well, that might happen when my mother got in contact with him. You know, I mean, you know, but those are the guys driving the import SUVs, living in the McMansions, you know. I like my doctor and his Subaru wagon, which is exactly what we drive.
Probably got a little Grateful Dead dancing bear on the back, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. Although I gotta tell you, Spike, I don't know
if he's into that, but
that horn sticker looks good on the back of yours.
Yeah. Yes. Right above a Pearl Jam and Alice Chalmers stickers, actually.
Yeah, I noticed the Alice Chalmers sticker. I mean, it takes a real man to remember, well, to even know what Alice Chalmers is or was.
Yeah, I'm starting to drive my mother and girlfriend nuts with my interest in vintage tractors. Last summer, I went to many farm fairs here in Pennsylvania. There's tons of them in Pennsylvania. And, I like looking at the old tractors. I'm like a little kid when anything mechanical, and I'm kind of drawn in. And, yeah, the old orange tractor, that gets a thumbs up from me, as does Fromm Hall as well. Some things brought to us that are a little polluted from the Industrial Revolution that also at one time helped the family farmers out quite a bit. And sadly, that's another group I really hope somebody from this administration soon really starts to help. I know, you know, Obama was supportive of farm aid when he was a senator. Let's hope that you know, trickles down. Because a lot of our pollution problems actually comes from factory farms, not the family farmers, so. Yeah, I think Americans need to learn kind of the rights and wrongs, or, you know, I'm not sure what the good cliche phrase is for what people should know, the facts and myths or whatever about pollutions due to agriculture. You know, who are the culprits? I think sometimes the family farmers kind of get lumped in with what the big conglomerates do, you know, the ones that are bringing in the illegal. You know,
well, yeah, the family farmer in America is under the boot heel of the corporate agribusiness. There's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, the Roundup Ready corn where they'll sue you if your patch shows some of it, you know, if some seed blew over onto your acreage, they'll sue you and try to run you out of business, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and then they're constantly trying to eat people up here. We're kind of lucky that there was when there was some more rational thinking going on, maybe, in Pennsylvania, there was a bipartisan effort that was put in place to start preserving farmlands, because also there's the fear that too many of the farms would be bought up by developers and just turned into basically New Jersey.
That's really you know, we got is. Hey, Spike, you're not helping, buddy. We got New Jersey listeners, okay? I mean, yeah, remember.
Well, you know, for those who wonder why the state would maybe the worst pollution from just traffic emissions, it's called the Garden State. They used to have lots of farms. Now they're all townhouses and McMansions.
Oh, I know. And it's happened all over the country. Perfectly good farm ground. And you'll see a notice in the local paper. It says auction Saturday. 250 acres farmland suitable for development.
Yeah, yeah. That I cringe when I see that, you know, because what's become maybe my biggest summertime thing to do is, you know, I drive an Echo, gets good gas, so I can go on these kind of rides, is driving around rural Pennsylvania to different farmers and basically doing my produce shopping that way. You know, it might take me.
You live in a place where summertime comes and you can go out and about and get a tomato.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can go to different places, different parts of Pennsylvania if I want to spend the time, and, you know, and different things are in season. You know, Pittston, which is near Wilkes-Barre, they have the big tomato festival. Yeah, luckily they still a slight love for food that tastes like something. Because I can't even eat tomatoes during the heart of the winter.
Oh, no, you know, you walk into a sandwich shop or something and they lift that little steel lid over the place where they've got the perfectly sliced tomatoes, and they're kind of, at best, on the outside, they're a whitish pink, and on the inside, they're a sort of translucent styro gray, and you're just, nah, no tomatoes today, or those either.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's exactly. I got my big garden about to start up here soon enough. So.
Oh, are you really? You got your ground turned and everything?
Actually, we're going to do that this weekend, because I'm probably not going to get most of those plants in until probably mid to late May.
Yeah, see, around here, we've got a rule of thumb that you're really not out of the woods sticking anything in the dirt until Mother's Day.
Yeah, well, basically, we have to here, especially in Toby Hanna. We got snow one Mother's Day many years ago, so...
Oh, yeah, you've got a little elevation on you.
Yeah, yeah, well, back in the day, Toby Hanna was, the big industry was ice. They would harvest ice for ice boxes before refrigeration killed this town's economy, basically. Kind of the original Detroit. But, it gets really cold here sometimes out of the blue when you least expect it. I mean, we got on the 28th of October, I think, 16 inches.
Oh, I saw that photograph you put on your blog. It was just mind-blowing.
Yeah, so growing in some parts of Pennsylvania is a little harder than others. You get near Lancaster, York County, that area, they're basically already got stuff in the ground going, because that's a little more south and warm.
Oh, you know, and that's the Amish, man. They were starting seeds at Christmas.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah.
So are you gonna plant any nice heirloom seed tomatoes? Nice Brandywine or some such?
No, I don't have any heirloom. I kind of cheat a little too. I use a Burpee seedlings, because it's kind of hard for the way I'm set up to really grow too many. I got a few seeds that I got started in the house, but like my tomato plants, I just kind of they come shipped to me from Burpees from Pennsylvania anyway. So
right.
They just send me a package in UPS, and I'm set. So that I cheat a little that ways. But I did start some okra from seeds. I couldn't really get the corn going. I had a red corn, but that really didn't. Only one grew, and it kind of died quickly. So that's kind of a wash. But looks like I'll have some cauliflower, too, that I got started.
Oh, yum. Yeah, fresh Brussels sprouts. Can't beat those either. I know, and right now about 60% of my audience is going, ew, Brussels sprouts, ew.
You know, fresh produce, you know, it's kind of like that Jon Stewart bit in the Dave Chappelle movie, Half-Baked. And you know, with the, you know, John Stewart's character was always, you know, you ever do this on weed? You ever see it on weed? And it's kind of with fresh fruit. You ever have it with fresh produce? You know, it just makes everything so much better. It really does. So that was a joke that took way too long to get to the punchline. But and also before I forget, we got the weirdest poll call to my mother's line tonight. They said they were American something. I called them back and got a message saying they were Western Watts. They were asking about, like, development and do we – it sounded like a push poll to me with the questions, but they kept calling my mom sir, so eventually that set her off and she hung up on them. She has a deep voice, but, I mean, when someone tells you they're not a man, don't keep saying sir.
Yeah.
But it was – questions like, would we want to spend so much in bonds to keep our game lands, which Pennsylvania has a lot of game lands, so you can go hunting and fishing and, you know, things like that, or shooting guns to allegedly plot to attack Fort Dix. That was on game land property also, that story. But we have lots of land for that kind of stuff for sportsmen.
Oh, gosh, yeah. And what, a little, I guess maybe a little south of you down into Bucks County and stuff?
No, Bucks has actually become more suburban. Up by me, actually, is where all the game, like up here, they have tons of game lands.
Oh, really?
The most of my township is game lands and the Army base. So, yeah, no, we up in the central and north and west is where the game lands are really big. And they were asking questions like, you know, would we want to spend, you know, so much to keep protecting it? And that just kind of sounded like a push-pull, but the weird thing is they asked before it started, does a reporter live in your house? Now, I've gotten many a calls from pollsters.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had a pollster want to make sure a reporter isn't around for these questions. So I'm very suspicious what Western Watts and whatever name they're working under.
Oh, yeah, they want to make sure that they and see, they think that my aunt, well, is there a reporter in your, and if you're a reporter, you're going to go, yeah, I'm a reporter. No, you're going to go, oh, shoot, no. We kill those on site. What's your question, buddy? Let me start the recording device.
Yeah, I mean, unless you, only someone from the New York Post maybe would be dumb enough to say, yeah, there's a reporter here. Yeah. You know, Bill O'Reilly would be dying. Yeah, I'm a reporter. I got a Peabody.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Speaking of Bill O, I read earlier today, Spike, and you might get a kick out of this. His little stalker, Jesse Waters.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, the guy that does the ambushes.
Yeah, the guy that basically is ripping off Stutter and John.
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Well, he is going to be attending Netroots Nation this August in Pittsburgh. You know, that's what used to be known as Yearly Coast.
Oh, okay.
And nobody has gotten around to telling Bill O'Reilly that Netroots Nation is not affiliated with Daily Coast, that it's its own animal. But so the little ambush boy is going to be attending Netroots Nation in Pittsburgh. And if everything goes right and, you know, the wind blows from the right direction and we hold one arm in the air and stick our tongue out and don't move, and we'll be there, too. So the horn will stalk Bill O'Reilly's stalker.
You know, I should go along and just do my, and follow him and just do my Stutter and John imitation.
Oh, that'd work. That'd work. I was thinking we would, at our broadcast table, Spike, that we would put out a plate with some Middle Eastern treats on it and assign free falafel for Fox employees.
Cucumber sauce on the side.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, that yogurt with the, yeah, yeah. Love that stuff.
Or maybe Bill likes to put the cucumber sauce elsewhere.
Oh, yeah, don't go there.
Before I go any further.
Yeah. Well, it's awful good to hear from you, Spike. Have you been to a ball game yet or anything?
Yeah, I've been to a minor league ball game, actually. I went with a radio show to the home opener for the Iron Pigs in Lehigh Valley. They played the Scranton Yankees. Scranton Yankees just blew them out of the water. Yankees have a great minor league system going on right now, and they don't use any of them. They spent
no, those are trade fodder. That's an entire farm system of players to be named later.
Well, let me tell you something. Make a trade. Anyone out there looking to get some good guys that are going to waste, make a trade with the Yankees. They got plenty of minor league prospects that you're going to have fun with.
Well, what level are the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs?
That's AAA. So that's.
Oh, no kidding. Who's AAA? Is that the Phil's AAA affiliate or?
Yeah, the Iron Pigs are the Phillies, and the Scranton Yankees are the New York Yankees affiliate. How an original.
What league is that?
That's in the International League.
No kidding.
The Durham Bulls, who are the Rays AAA team, are in there. The Charlotte Knights, who used to be the White Sox, I'm not sure if they are. Some of them are hard to keep track because they change a lot.
Yeah, but, see, way back in the day.
Toledo Mud Hens.
The Mud Hens, sure. The Pawtucket. Is Pawtucket?
Sox.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And see, I way back in the day, I used to go down the when we'd be up here on vacation, go down the river. We always tried to schedule. Dad always tried to schedule his vacations when the Charleston Charlies would be in town because they were the AAA International League affiliate of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Okay, yeah.
And I mean that's way back when. I mean, you know, I saw some ball players on the way up and on the way down. Saw Dave Park.
Yeah.
I saw Dave Parker play AAA ball.
Yeah, the list of guys I've probably seen over the years, some of them I can't even remember, you know, I'm not even sure if I was at games they're at, but there's some I definitely, I mean, you know, Ryan Howard, Chase Utley, those guys more recently, Mike Lieberthal, who was with the Phillies for like a decade as their catcher, Todd Pratt, who he was one of those guys in the steroid report, but he was a backup catcher. He wasn't really some dude getting buff, getting big money.
Yeah.
Just all kinds of. I mean, during the years, I would go to minor league games as a kid. I mean, Derek Jeter played with the Columbus Clippers, and I think I actually was at a game he was at. It's cool to see guys that go on to be really big, you know, before they're big, or to see guys. Sometimes it's funny to see guys who you know their name and you know they're playing in minor league. It was Morgan Ensberg, I think, was one. I was surprised one night there. Melky Cabrera with the Yankees. Sometimes that's interesting too, or seeing rehab assignments. But that was an interesting night. And Larry Holmes threw out the first pitch that night too. Did himself a disservice. He stood behind the rubber and threw it and bounced it on the plate. So he's better at throwing punches, I think, than baseballs. But I think if he would have just stood on the rubber, he actually would have made it. So that's impressive either way. It's hard to talk any trash about a guy who could probably knock me out in one shot.
Yeah, yeah.
If I've referenced too much sports and
no, that's okay. We got to do that from time to time. It is good hearing from you, Spike.
All right, my man.
All right, we'll talk to you later, brother.
Later.
Bye now. Our good buddy Spike from Easton, PA, keeping it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan.
Boys and girls. Get out your pencils and paper and write down this phone number. It's 202-225-2071. And then tomorrow you can very respectfully call up Virginia Fox's office in D.C. and say that wasn't a very nice thing to do, especially since in a quote from Representative Steve Cohen, Democrat of Tennessee. Matthew Shepard's mother was in the gallery yesterday, and I believe she was back today. So I'm sorry she had to be around to hear it.
Indeed. You know, that's one just miserable, miserable human being, Virginia Fox. I mean, you know, you just kind of want her world to just want her to slide into that Warner Brothers universe so somebody can drop an anvil on her.
Yeah. Now, you see, if I was the type of person she is, I would wish something really bad to happen to her, something along the lines of maybe what happened to Matthew Shepard. But I happen to be better than she is. I just hope one day something will cause her to wake up and realize how much she is hurting people, and needlessly. I don't think it's ever going to happen.
No, she's a pig licking.
I can always hope. Yeah, she's pretty much a lost cause. you know, it's just... Now, for a couple of fun facts about Dear Virginia. December 2005, she was one of 11 members of Congress to vote against the hurricane aid to Katrina. She was also one of only 33 Republicans to vote against the extension of the Voting Rights Act. And in the, she did do something positive in the lame duck session of 2006. She introduced a bill praising, a joint resolution praising the Christmas tree industry that passed the House but died the Senate.
Oh, yeah, so she really is one of those.
Yes, one of those. I mean, good grief. My congressman isn't known to be as being the, you know, brightest, you know, the sharpest knife in the drawer, and he's not known for being a real go-getter. But for crying in the beer, even he manages to do stuff. God.
I know.
One can only hope, though, that seeing her age, Darwin will eventually take over.
Well, entropy, really. Not so much Darwin, just entropy. It catches up with all of us.
Yeah.
And,
Well, I was thinking Darwin in the sense that an unsuccessful species dies out.
Well, that is what's going on, Susan. It really is.
Yeah.
You know, when they've gone from 36% nationally to 21% nationally, I mean, that's a pretty precipitous drop. There is a political sea change at work in this country. Whose answer I don't fully know. You know, I always check in and listen to Malloy of an evening after my show's over. And I noticed him repeating a theme last night that because of the contraction into a weird little southern cultish all white party, the Republican Party is going the way of all flesh. And Mike asserted that the new center right party in America will be the Democratic Party, and then toward the end of the program said it falls to us, to real liberals, to invent the party that stands for real American values.
Yeah, ain't that the truth?
And there is truth in that. The question you have to answer is whether or not the Democratic Party is done for.
Yeah.
I hope it's not. I hope it's not. But you know this is why I can't get all a flutter about Arlen Specter becoming the 60th Senate vote.
No, neither can I.
Because he's not going to be that 60th Senate vote for things that matter. Here in about 40 minutes, we'll be talking with Rick Smith, I hope.
Oh, goody. I've been dying to find out what he was going to say about this.
And, well, you will find out. And I think we'll probably have the best perspective we could possibly have on how labor plans to deal with Arlen Specter's perfidy. And, you know, it's going to be another one of those nights on the horn where you hear it here first.
Yeah, I really hope what labor does is say, I don't care if you did change parties, we still aren't backing you, and that means you stick a fork in him, he's done.
Indeed.
Because he can't win in Pennsylvania without labor. Oh, here is one. Okay. Previous administrations, the outgoing president, whatever his poll numbers were, he leaves office, and then after a while, his numbers gradually creep up. And that even happened with Tricky Dicky. Georgia's, our dear chimp, gibbering chimp.
Yeah, the chimp in chief.
His numbers have dropped.
Yeah, and continue. And Dick Cheney's are down somewhere around pig vomit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just, God, these people are strange people. Anyway, just thought I'd toss that in about dear old Senator Fox. And by the way, I did make a few calls about the Obama's determination that the Fourth Circuit decision warrants no further.
Yeah, well, no. Oh. Go ahead.
I made a few calls saying, hey, guys, you now own this issue. When a dam goes and kills a bunch of people, and it will sooner or later, you own it.
Maybe we can just have warrants no further review tattooed on their foreheads.
Yeah. I came right out and said, hey, guys, you had a chance to step in. Instead, you followed Bush's lead. Fine. You now own this, and when people die, it's on you. And they will die. It's as certain as the sun coming up in the morning, sooner or later, one of those dams is going to go.
And the fact of the matter is, it's not just that. It's the future.
Yeah.
It's
Well, I brought that into it. I brought in the ecological time bomb. One guy I was talking to in Merkley's office said, is this an Oregon issue or a national issue? I said it's both, because that coal that comes out of West Virginia is put on a boat, sent to China, and it comes back to Oregon in the form of air pollution. And I've got satellite photos to prove it.
Good. Good. That's, that's the way you have to make it real for them.
So the Democratic Party now owns the issue of mountaintop removal. Let's hope they...
Yeah, in a variety of ways. I was reading, if you want to, the best ongoing updates of mountaintop removal issues are at WVGazette.com, and you click on something called Coal Tattoo. And Ken Ward keeps a pretty close eye on what happens with that issue. There was at first some initial happiness, joy even the other day, when the Department of the Interior under Ken Salazar said it was going to roll back the Bush's buffer zone rule change.
Mm-hmm.
But then people began digging around a little further, and lo and behold, while they said that, they also made it clear that they were not going to do anything to stop the creation of valley fills, that they were not going to do anything to in any wise impede the further destruction and devastation and the devaluation of Appalachia and the marginalization of Appalachian American people.
Well, I guess I wasn't wrong in coming out and calling President Obama just another coal whore.
He's
sorry, but I did. I was ticked.
Yeah, it's disheartening to say the least. Because there are clear signs of good intentions being manifested for a lot of people around the country. They he said today that the government's on top of this flu thing, and that it is being prioritized at all levels of government, and I have a feeling they'll get it right. It's just that, once again, Appalachian people are, a little less than American.
Mm-hmm.
We're just sitting here we're just sitting here in the way of America's coal.
We are
expendable.
Now, like I said, who cares about people in West Virginia? They're just a bunch of hillbillies, right?
Yep. That's us.
And I told him, well, God damn it, you should.
I know.
Pardon me, I get really ticked.
I know it gets frustrating, doesn't it? Susan, good talking to you, dear.
Yeah, you have a good evening.
I'm going to try.
Where's Berg?
He's running hither, thither, and yon. Well, not running. He's kind of limping. He's got a bum knee right now, but a couple of neighbor kids that come up here looking for him to play with him were pecking on the studio door a few minutes ago, so he's kind of taking care of that.
Well, kids got to be...
Even Horn interns junior grade get a little bit of slack around here. I'm a pretty easy boss. Especially considering, you know, what I pay him.
Yeah, when you're not paying in anything, it kind of, you know, yeah. There's got to be some kind of job work.
Right, and, you know, he's getting all this room and board and upkeep and, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Susan, we'll talk to you soon. Have a good
one. Okay. You too.
Bye-bye.
Love to Agnes. Bye-bye.
Bye. News Ninja Susan from Columbia City, Oregon. Yeah, I do. I hope you wrote down that number. I'll find it later in the program, give it out again. Let Virginia Fox's office know very politely. And you can use some big words if you want to. They'll be amazed by them, and you'll send them scurrying cockroach-like for their dictionaries. But use them gently and politely and let them know what a vile excuse for a member of the human race Virginia Fox is. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
When you said that Fox, she was the one I was trying to think of the other day. That it's just about every time I watch the House of Representatives, I see that woman, and she's always pontificating about how wonderful the Republicans are and how horrible the Democrats are and blah, blah, this. But the way that sounded to me was like she was trying to make it sound like that Matthew was going to rob them.
You know, at this point, I don't know what goes on in the weird little mind of a right-winger.
I mean, I never heard anybody talk like that before about it. And, you know... it certainly didn't end up being a robbery, just a robbery.
Far from it. Never was to begin with. But when you're a Repiglick and Juanita, and your whole when the very blood oozing through your circulatory system is laced with hate, you can say any vile, pathetic, disgusting lie that you want to, and it's all okay because
yeah.
It's for the good of the party.
You're right. But it was funny. This morning, I got somebody else to add to your list if you ever This morning, I turned into C-SPAN, and I guess they had some new congressmen on there because when I turned it on, they had a Democratic congressman on. And I never did get his name because I got in the middle of it, but I liked what he had to say. And then they had a new congressman from Texas. Have you noticed Pete Olson from Texas?
No.
Oh, boy.
Do we have a new loony?
Oh, my gosh. Let me tell you. First of all, now I know this is not nice of me to say this. But I can't help it. first of all, the guy looks like he's the son of the guy that flew the plane to England during World War II, the Nazi.
Oh, really?
Looks like he's his son. He talks a lot like, what's the guy that is a fictional character anyway?
Forrest Gump?
Yeah.
How did I know?
Anyway, everybody that called in to ask him a question, he said, oh, I don't care what it was. Oh, that's a good question. He never did answer it right. And then he said, yeah, I know they talked about the budget. He said, well, you know, We know that Bush didn't do what was right about that, but said, after all, you shouldn't blame him for the last 2 years because the Democrats had control of everything. And some woman called in and said, well, what about the Democrats trying to pass insurance for the children and him not voting? And he said, well, if they had it so, like a severe, you know, that then he would have voted for it. But anyway, but what was really funny was somebody called in and he says that, well, you know, what really happened was we had these tea parties and, you know, people really coming out. And he brought a sign that this little girl had. It was one of those stop signs. It looked like a real stop sign that said, this little girl gave this to me. And he showed it on the show, Bob. And it just touched your heart. Anyway, he said, stop spending my money or whatever.
No, for pity's sake.
And he had people. That was his illustration. And isn't it illegal to steal a stop sign anyway? But I'm sure it was a real stop sign. But, I mean, maybe they don't have them like we have them down here. We have the oxygen shape, oxygen.
Octagon, yeah.
Yeah. Anyhow, he said, people was calling and said, well, if we're going to worry about our grandchildren, so we're not going to have any if we don't do something about our economy. And that's what always gets me. They always want to bring up about the grandchildren and the
children. But they didn't give a damn about the grandchildren while they were being bankrupted by George Bush and his stupid little war, Juanita, you know?
Right. But then another woman called up and she said, well, I would like to ask you the average income of his area
district.
Where he serves.
District.
Constituents, yeah.
Yeah.
She said, I would like to ask you, what is the average income of the middle class and the poor class? Well, ma'am, I don't know that. I serve all the people. I serve all the people in
America. Oh, wow. This really was Forrest Gump style, wasn't it?
You just got to hear him, Bob. Yeah, I think if you see him, you'll know who he is. But I thought, my word, this is the kind of person they're bringing.
And give me his name again.
Huh?
Give me his name again.
Pete Olson, Olson, from Texas.
Oh yeah, I'll put the weather vane up for that because this guy.
Well,
ought to be good.
What was that guy that flew to from? He was in Hitler's.
Oh, I can't remember. I know who you're talking about, but yeah.
That's who it looks like. It might be his grandson or his. Now, that's mean of me, I know. But.
Well, you know, he probably behaves a lot like
him. We have to have, you know. The guy was just act like a dumb dingbat.
You've got to act that way in order to be a member of the Republican Party anymore. You've got to understand the average IQ of the Republicans in the House is somewhere around my shoe size.
13?
Yeah.
I don't know that.
I don't know. That's like magic.
I'm going by my son. You're at the same height, right?
About 6'2".
Yeah.
6'2" and way too much.
Yeah.
W-E-I-G-H and W-A-Y.
I love to hear your son laughing at your joke.
he's a piece of work. He really is.
Yeah. But anyway, and then they had a little thing on today about poor little Hannity.
Oh, really? Did he, did he scrape his little knee?
No, it's about the waterboarding.
Oh, is him all afraid?
Elizabeth said, what's his face, didn't have any reason to butt into that show. He had nothing to do with that show, you know, the one with Charles Grodin.
Yeah.
And he had no business. I mean, she was, you know. And
You know, I think she's got a crush on him.
Well, you know, they're like people think. Like, I used to. No, this is bad.
And they are repig licking, so that means they change spouses as often as normal people change socks.
I'm going to say something is bad.
Okay.
Again. But when I was a kid, some of the Church of God people,
mm-hmm.
and I love them, I had a lot of friends in that church, but some of their boyfriends, after they got up in their teens and all,
yeah,
and they thought they were so handsome, and their hair was like it was, this is before teased hair, too. It was like it was stopped to the skies or something, you know. It wasn't.
Well, did you ever see that wonderful old John Wayne movie, True Grit?
No, I haven't.
Oh, darn it. You missed one. There's the young girl in dressing down Glenn Campbell character, who's, of course, a Texas Ranger, makes some remark to him about and Texans who dress their hair like lettuce.
Well, it would be unbelievable. And these girls would just go crazy over these guys. Their hair was like...
They've kept the same hairdo for 50...
3 inches ahead of their forehead.
Yeah, they've kept the same hairdo all their lives, and it just gets thinner and thinner and thinner, and they keep combing it over and over and over.
Yeah.
Yep, yeah. Know exactly what you're... I know. I grew up with those people, too, Juanita.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, so I'm sure that people do think that he is. I know he thinks he's awful good-looking, and I guess if he did as good as he looked, maybe he'd be all right.
Well, that's why I refer to him as little more than a life support system for a haircut.
Yeah. Well, his hair ain't even in what I was talking about, but yet and still, it's still the whole package of him.
Yes.
And then I'll never forget seeing him on that documentary from Utah.
Yeah.
Where they were going to have these college kids was going to have
where he debated yeah,
and him getting up there, he liberal, and mocking. You know, there was some of the professors there that were liberal. You know, and they were just mocking mm-hmm. them, and the crowd just go, oh, that's so funny. He said, here, liberal. I never will forget him saying that.
Yeah.
And then when somebody...
Well, you know, there's another one that you're just waiting for an anvil to fall out of the sky on.
Yeah. They say he's going to back out of the waterboarding because he was just kidding. Have you heard that?
Yeah. No, which means he's just chicken.
Oh, now that's the one I wish people could call or do something. Just let him have it and just call and just say...
Well, Olbermann's escalating it.
And he's got somebody that knows how to do it, too, that was willing to do it.
Oh, I'm sure.
But if we could all go, quack, 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 you know. When the Beatles came over, there were some comedians from England, a group, a couple, and I don't remember their names, but they did it. They would squawk like a chicken for a whole session, you know, or skit. And they'd be going, quack, 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 quack.
Oh, how the times have changed. Hey, Juanita, you have yourself a good evening here.
Hey, I'm sorry for being so silly. But
No, don't apologize. We specialize in silly here.
Yeah. Well, silly people have fun.
All right, you take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye now.
Night-night.
And, just to update you real quick, in case you didn't catch them when Susan gave them out. You can reach Virginia Fox's Washington office at area code 202-225-2071. Just find yourself a zip code somewhere in Boone, North Carolina. When they say, you know, where are you from? Just tell them you're from Boone or Clemens. Clemens or Boone, North Carolina. And, I just wanted to let you know that was disgraceful the way you talked about that poor boy. You know, that kind of thing.
That way, if you're, you know, if, because, well, make it sound kind of down homey if you know what I mean. Area code 202-225-2071. That's the office of Repiglican Representative Virginia Fox in the Longworth House office building. You got a really cool cafeteria in the bottom of that thing, by the way. Area code 202-225-2071. We are an hour and 10 minutes into this Wednesday night prayer meeting edition of The Horn. And you're, of course, welcome to come on down to the pulpit and testify, brethren and sistren. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on, H-E-A-D-O-N. Or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email rolls into Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. And we'll take a little break, and we'll be right back. Somehow, talking about Ollis Chalmers tractors put me in the mind of this tune. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Bulldozers in dirt, bulldozers in dirt. What's your mama got hidden up her shirt? I like to play and I like to work, but most of all I like bulldozers and dirt. I met your mom when I was 19. You couldn't have been any more than 3. She caught me stealing y'all's color TV. She called the cops and they arrested me. She was the wildest thing I'd ever seen. The way she pointed that shotgun at me. The police hauled my ass off to jail. Your mama signed the trail to help make the bail.
Bulldozers and dirt, bulldozers and dirt. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. According to the Associated Press, Fiat will sign the deal forming a partnership with Chrysler. Major banks have already agreed to substantially reduce Chrysler's debt, and the United Auto Workers Union has agreed to concessions. All these things were conditions set by the Obama administration for Chrysler to get more federal loans and avoid bankruptcy. GM continues to deal with its creditors in an effort to cut its debts as it talks with the UAW to resolve outstanding retiree health care and other issues. GM's bid to avoid bankruptcy hinges on reaching agreements with the union and with its creditors by a June 1st deadline imposed by the Obama administration. Workers are still reeling from the economy as new numbers show U.S. gross domestic product contracted by 6.1% between January and March. In the final quarter of 2008, it shrank by 6.3%. It's the worst economic decline since 1958. Business capital investment dropped by 38% in the first quarter. For workers, this means that job losses will continue this year. More than 5 million workers have lost jobs so far during this recession. More than 5,000 workers are killed on the job every year in the U.S. Another 50,000 die each year from occupation-related diseases. At the National Labor College in Maryland, Labor Secretary Hilda Solis marked Workers' Memorial Day this week by vowing to ramp up safety enforcement for workers on the job.
When it comes to workplace protection, workplace health, and workplace safety, let me be clear. The Department of Labor is back in the enforcement business. Under my watch, enforcement of our labor laws will be intensified to provide an effective deterrent to employers who put their workers' lives at risk.
Yesterday marked 100 days for the nation's 44th president, but in that time, what has he accomplished for workers? Jesse Russell has more.
The AFL-CIO has released a list highlighting a number of landmark moments in President Barack Obama's first 100 days. One of the standout moments for workers was the passage of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. The act helps level the playing field when it comes to gender pay equity. He also established a new task force chaired by Vice President Joe Biden, dedicated to raising the standard of living in the middle class. Obama used his executive power to erase setbacks for workers of the Bush administration, including reversing an order that limited union representation on federal contracts. He has also expressed a commitment to infrastructure by setting a course that will support the development of green jobs, which could potentially create a new industry for middle-class workers.
Detroit takes another hit as American Axle idles its largest plant in mid-July. The company depends on auto manufacturers. GM accounts for 75% of American Axle's business, Chrysler 10%. 500 workers are being let go. More work will be transferred to Mexico. After the plant shut down, American Axle will just have 232 employees left in Michigan. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
One past the hour on this Wednesday night prayer meeting. We will take a little detour from our prayer meeting activities. Step outside the Cathedral of Common Sense and into the bright daylight of the real world in which we live. I promised you earlier in the program, and I will fulfill that promise presently, that we will be joined for the first time, and it is a long time coming and way too long as far as I'm concerned, joined for the first time by our comrade on the weekend schedule of the Horn, our comrade Rick Smith. Now, just to let you know, Rick walks the walk and Rick talks the talk. He's a working guy just like the rest of us. No divas on the Horn. There's no room for divahood in the working class. And Rick gets up and goes to work every day, but on the weekends he follows a mission that sort of came to him after the defeat of John Kerry in 2004. He, like so many of us, became absolutely disgusted with the prevalence of right-wing hate speech dominating the airwaves. And he took to the airwaves himself up in Pennsylvania. And we're awfully proud to run Rick's show on the weekend, his Saturday show and his Sunday show. So welcome, Rick Smith. Awfully glad to have you along.
Thanks so much, Bob. I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I've been thinking about you ever since the Spectre news came out yesterday, so I dropped you a line earlier. Because his press release where he said, oh, by the way, I'm still going to screw working people, it sort of hung in my craw. I just couldn't imagine that it didn't do the same thing to you.
Well, you know, here's the thing. The reality is you look at Arlen Specter, and he's playing the tea leaves. He understands that big business fills his coffers, and this is purely a money decision, Bob. He needs a campaign contribution.
But doesn't somewhere along the way, doesn't he need votes too, Rick?
And that's what kind of gets me. I mean, with the way Labor gets out at election time and supports candidates, you would think he would have made the political calculus to realize that if he backdoors Labor, they're not going to come to his aid, or at least I hope they're not. I mean, what bothers me is, during the 2006 run for the Senate, Bob Casey ran against Rick Santorum. You actually had unions in this state who supported Santorum.
Oh, God.
And, you know, it just boggles the mind. But, you know, whatever backroom deals they made, I got to tell you, I'm really interested to see how this plays out in a couple of months. See what kind of deals the Democratic Party made with Specter. See what kind of deals Specter made with Labor. What scares me to death, I'll be honest, what scares me to death is that Specter is going to lead a compromise on the Employee Free Choice Act. And if you've read what his compromise is, it's worse than the law is today.
Oh, you mean where, and I've seen the compromise touted by people like Evan Bayh and some others as well. Is that the compromise where, like, 99% of the people have to sign cards?
Well, that's part of it. The other part is instant decertification, where the employer can start a decertification vote. I mean, that's the part that gets me, the fact that I can have an employer go and start pushing a decertification? Are you kidding me? I thought the union was about workers. When do we start pandering to corporate America? I'm telling you, it's one of the things that has me just scared to my core. Because what really bothers me is Specter is going to be one of those moderates. He's going to fit nicely in with the Blue Dogs. And I'm afraid that you're going to see a much more powerful, much more emboldened Blue Dog Democrat.
Yeah, and we need that like we need a case of the plague. Oh, sorry, bad reference. you're absolutely right, Rick. What is there leverage? You know, you said, you know, see what kind of deal making's going on. Is there any kind of, is there leverage that can be brought to bear? I mean, you know, you yourself are a member of the Teamsters, a proud member of the Teamsters. The AFL-CIO has an active presence in Pennsylvania. Is there any way to do any political arm twisting on this?
Well, I think there has been a lot of that going on behind the scenes. I think Spector, when he made his choice, I kind of think he thought that Labor would kind of go easy on him. In this state, I know the AFL-CIO came out very strong and said, you know, you've got to support this. They had a huge rally in front of his office in Harrisburg. Took 4,000 letters to his office just from the people in the Harrisburg area. There's been a lot of pressure on this. And Spector himself has said that this one piece of legislation is the most heavily lobbyist bill since he's been in the Senate. That's saying something. Corporate America understands that if Labor just gets a small bit of an advantage, because believe me when I tell you this, Bob, this piece of legislation is not radical change. This is very, very modest change. If I wrote this bill, we would go back to the original intent of the law, which was workers sign cards, workers have a union. There's no...
Well, I mean, when you get right down to it, Rick, isn't the original intent of the law a manifestation of the reality of First Amendment freedom of association?
Absolutely. And, you know, and this is what I asked my friends at the Chamber of Commerce. You know, can you show me anything in our society where I sign a contract, I sign my name on the dotted line, and I have someone who's going to question me later, and then I have to walk into a voting booth when somebody else tells me, like a trained monkey? Are you kidding? But, you know, that's the system that we have. And this all came throughout years of conservatives destroying workers' rights. You go back to Taft-Hartley, Land of Griffin, all of this stuff, taking rights away from workers. And what bothers me is the big money in this country, the big money, the Richard Mellon's Gates, the Coors, the Olin Foundations, all of these big money groups, they have figured out how to divide you and I, Bob. And that's the amazing thing. I stood on the steps of the Capitol when Joe the Unlicensed Plumber came to town for his Save the Secret Ballot tour.
Yeah, Joe the Scab.
Yeah, well, you'll love this. Joe came to Save the Secret Ballot, came to Harrisburg, brought a little voting booth with him, but wouldn't let anybody vote. You know, I'm standing in line and go, I want to cast my vote. Oh, no, because you'll vote the wrong way. That's what the guy told me.
Oh, you're kidding.
They brought this vote. There were like 16 people there who supported Joe the Unlicensed Plumber, and there were like 400 union members. So Joe the Unlicensed Plumber, needless to say, went home after that appearance. Didn't even bother going to Philadelphia. Smart guy. I give him credit for being smart enough to know that he shouldn't have gone down to Philadelphia. But, yeah, they brought this whole big tour in, and it was beautiful. They put up this voting booth, and it would let no one vote. But, you know, the point here is, they've figured out, by spending just a little bit of money, how to divide us. And I stood there, I'm watching on the capitalist steps, watching these people who support Joe the Unlicensed Plumber and had not read the bill, know nothing about organized labor, know nothing about labor law, yet they're against working people having the right to organize. And it was amazing to me how simple it was to divide us. And I go back to the old John Jay quote. Remember the railroad magnate? Back in the robber baron era, back in the 1880s, he said, I can easily pay half the country to kill the other half.
And exactly.
I looked at the Capitol steps and I go, this is what he was talking about, right here. You got working people at each other's throats. And did you ever see the movie Hoffa?
Oh, yeah.
Movie Hoffa. Remember the famous scene where they're down, you know, they're beating the snot out of each other? And Hoffa looks up and he sees the police chief and the business owners up in the window, and they close the drapes on him.
That's what I felt.
I felt that, you know, the moneyed interests are up there watching and smiling down on what they had created, and that's what's going on.
Well, let me ask you, as far as labor in Pennsylvania is concerned, Rick, what kind of percentage numbers are there statewide? I mean, how many folks are members of organized labor?
It depends on which part of the state you're in. I don't know if you've heard the famous quip that there's Pittsburgh on one end, Philadelphia on the other and Alabama in the middle.
Yeah, but I would. You're a Pennsylvanian. And I wasn't going to drop that on you because I'm from Alabama. So.
But here's the point. You have very strong union on one end, very strong union on the other, and very weak union in the middle. So when you get to Pittsburgh and you get to Philadelphia, very, very good numbers. You're in the middle of the state, not so much. So I don't have the numbers right in front of me. I'm under the impression that it's about 17% in the state as a total.
Well, the other question, and I ask primarily because those numbers will determine what kind of leverage there is. I mean, how on earth can Arlen Specter expect to win, even if you assume the Democratic primary, which I'm not willing to do, but how can he expect to win a general election with organized labor not in his corner? Is it one of those things where he just assumes that because Pat Toomey is crazier than Sprayed Roach that the organized labor will vote for him by default as the lesser of two evils?
Yeah, I think you've nailed that on the head. I think that's what his calculus is. And like I said at the beginning, it depends on what deals he made with the Democratic Party. Did he make a deal to keep somebody out that would challenge him in the primaries? Because I got to tell you, I don't know how he wins the primary. Because I don't know how any working person, how any labor person could support him. If Pat Toomey wins the Republican nomination, it doesn't matter what Democrat they run. He's going to lose because he's crazy as a loon.
Yeah, I mean, he really is. I mean, crazy, right?
No, absolutely. He is so far out there. He is so far on the radical fringe. It's not even funny. But here's the thing: that's the new face of the Republican Party, and that's what you know. I got to give credit to Arlen on one level. He has realized that his party has really left him. He is out on an island by himself. So, to be honest, he didn't lose anything. The Republican Party wasn't supporting him anyway. So. Was it a calculated move? I think it was his only move. Because, to be honest, the Republicans weren't going to support him no matter what.
I mean, he was going to lose the Republican primary in 2010 because he almost lost his rear end in 2004 against the same guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and the reality is look, he's read the tea leaves. The Republican Party has gotten so radicalized in this state. That, I mean, the numbers have shrunk considerably because the more moderate, sane Republicans have left the party.
But where, you know, Specter noted that in his press release yesterday, Rick, the thousands upon thousands who registered as Democrats in this last election cycle in 2008. But does that really mean they're Democrats, or are these people just blowing in the wind?
Well, I think they're blowing in the wind. I think the Republican Party has left them. I hear again. This is an opportunity for Democrats. Honestly and truthfully, this is a chance for them to have one of those great realignments in history to where they reach out to those middle-of-the-road Republicans. Because, look, we all want the same things in this country. We all want good education for our children. We all want safe neighborhoods. We all want health care and all the things that Americans expect. We all want the same thing. It's just how do we get that?
But you can't have any of those things, Rick, with Republican policies. That's, you know, I sit here in my little studio with my little headphones on, and sometimes I feel like the headphones are expanding off of my ears because my head's going to explode. Because you can't have health care. You can't have a middle class. You can't have anything that's worth having in this country with Republican policies in play. I mean, dear God, did we not learn that in the last 8 years?
Well, I think this last election bore that out. I think moderate Republicans and sane people see that. I think the same part of the Republican Party sees that their party has left them. The ideology of the extreme right is not the ideology of mainstream America. No matter how much Rush Limbaugh bloviates on, and no matter how much these far right wing talking heads go on and on, what they are spewing is not what mainstream middle class America wants. I mean.
The question, I suppose, Rick, is how do we get mainstream America to understand that we understand, A, and that B, half measures and watered down, lily-livered attempts will not fix the problem. I mean, you and I, we're liberals. I mean, we know what it means. You've worked for Dennis Kucinich's in Dennis Kucinich's behalf. So have I. I think we're the same kind of people, and we've got that fundamental understanding that what we're talking about in terms of fixing America is, and I hate to use the word, and I hope there's no moderates listening, radical change.
Exactly. I mean, but here's the thing, Bob, and this is what I believe has to happen. When you look at the economy is not nearly bad enough for people to accept radical change. It goes back to the old labor saying that their bellies have to be empty before their heads get right. And we're piecemealing things, like you said, patchworking things together to kind of ease the pain. I think as more people lose their homes and as we continue to see more jobs flee this country in search of exploitable labor and exploitable environmental policy, I think you're going to see more and more people waking up. I'm seeing it here in central Pennsylvania. People that have been emailing me for years telling me that I'm a crackpot and off the, finally coming around saying, you know what? You were right. Oh, my God. If we would only listen. I think you're starting to get people who are waking up because they're losing their middle class standard of living. And, you know.
And they are realizing who took it away?
I do believe that. I always pin it back to Reagan because I say Reagan was really that person who really brought it full bore. It was starting before Reagan. The whole movement towards neoliberal trade policies really were starting before Reagan, but he really kicked it in overdrive. The whole deregulation movement started really under Nixon and into Carter, but Reagan kicked it into full gear. I think people are starting to see deregulation, bad idea. I don't know if you saw what Chelsea Sullenberg, the hero pilot, when he testified in front of Congress, said, look, they stole 40% of my wages. I don't get a pension. I think that resonates. When, you know, I know tons of people who've lost their pension, but the CEO of the company did very well.
Yeah, and when people like Captain Sullenberg and people like the third mate on the Maersk Alabama said we knew how to fight off these pirates because we're union men.
Joe Cronin.
Yeah, exactly. That's a little bit different than, and I mean no disrespect by this, but that's a little bit different than a Cecil Roberts or a John Sweeney or a labor leader standing up and talking about it. That's rank and file people saying this makes my life better. Go ahead.
Why I think with my program, people tend to look at my union message a little differently than if it were coming from the AFL-CIO or from a big union. Look, I tell my story. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I never imagined that I would live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers. Never imagined in a million years. But through hard work and my union, I've done well beyond what I ever imagined I could. And the reality is unions mean better wages, better working conditions, better health benefits, better pension plans. It means a voice on the job. And this is the message that I think American workers need to finally hear, because I think it's resonating with young people. The kids that I've been talking to, they're very willing to listen because they've been seeing their parents getting shafted for years, losing jobs, losing pensions, losing paying into their health care, on and on and on. The 401ks that they were promised were going to be there in their retirements, gone. I think there's an opportunity right now, Bob. I really believe there's an opportunity.
Well,
just get Arlen Specter on board.
And that's the monumental task in front of you. I'm so hopeful that you and the rest of your brothers and sisters in organized labor in Pennsylvania can get that job done. Has the campaign for that started, or are liberal Pennsylvanians just sort of looking around going, isn't there anybody we can run in this primary, please? I mean, is there a potential challenger to him out there?
There's nobody yet. There's one guy who's really a complete unknown, doesn't stand a snowball's chance. None of the big names have come out. And I think, I got to tell you, I think this thing with Specter has been in the works for a while. It's one of those backroom deals, makes me sick, but that's how politics works. He wasn't going to make a leap without knowing he was going to have a soft landing. And I'm very interested to see how this plays out, because personally, I believe there were some deals that I'm not happy with. Because no matter what, I'll tell you right now, I don't know that I can vote for Arlen Specter.
You won't vote for Pat Toomey, but there's no law against leaving it blank. I've been driven into the arms of none of the above a couple of times, Rick, and it's nothing that it, there's nothing pleasant about it. But you know, sometimes I get the sense that you and I are the same kind of guy. We take our morals into the voting booth.
You have to. I mean, you have to have principles in what you stand on, Bob. And this is where I think Republicans have taken ground that they don't deserve, that they claim they stand on some moral fiber, which they don't. They stand where the dollar signs are. You know, I don't believe a word that comes out of Rush Limbaugh's mouth, other than the fact that he's the defender of corporate America. I believe that. But all the rest of it, it's just nonsense. This is where I think Democrats have an opportunity, liberals have an opportunity, to join together and to really state their values. Say what it is that we believe in and stick to it and don't compromise. And that's what's driving me nuts right now. This Employee Free Choice Act is very modest change. And we have seen but a handful of Democrats. Phil Hare from Illinois, probably the only guy I've seen really come out and support the Employee Free Choice Act in the mainstream corporate media. You don't see other Democrats out there really pushing this through. And I got to tell you, one of the things that's bugging me about Barack Obama, and I know he's got a lot on his plate, but this Employee Free Choice Act should be a centerpiece in his economic recovery plan.
Absolutely.
It was for Roosevelt back when he took office in 33. Now, granted, Wagner wasn't passed till 35, so I'm giving Obama a little room here. But this should be the centerpiece, because this is how you recover the economy. You get money back in the workers' pockets.
And, well, this is what drives me absolutely bananas, Rick, is that employee free choice, you know, you use the right word there, centerpiece. Employee free choice solves more problems than I think even some folks in labor are fully cognizant of. It can go a long way toward actually solving the health care crisis in this country. It can solve the retirement crisis in this country. It can put the middle class back to rights. And you know, this is unassailable stuff. I mean, on the other side, you've got that, the senator from Walmart, Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas, saying, you know, in this economic crisis, we need to have a level playing field, and both sides need to come to the table and negotiate, and the Employee Free Choice Act just keeps that from happening. What?
No, it doesn't. It absolutely brings both parties to the table, because it says, here's a time frame. Hammer out an agreement. This is the time frame you have to do with it. It doesn't say we're going to impose the contract. We're setting up guidelines. You need to sit down and really, really work through an agreement. Because, and what I love hearing my right-wing crazies talk about, well, the unions are just going to sit back and let government impose a contract. Are you crazy? Nobody wants a contract imposed on them. They wanted to get to the bargaining table and get what they can get out of it.
Yeah, labor's already been down that road. The labor knows what an imposed contract looks like, and it's the last thing in the world labor wants.
Exactly. But, you know, hey, the uninformed buy into it. I mean, the thing you have to give conservatives credit for, Bob, is that they are masters at manipulating words and manipulating ideas. I mean, death tax, probably the greatest misinformation campaign in the history of the world. Because I had a guy tell me, well, I inherited $16,000. They're not going to tax me on that. Well, of course they're not.
No, they haven't been, and they're not going to. And
I go, you didn't make $3.5 million off of it, did you? Well, no. I go, that's when they start taxing you. Really?
Yeah, but, you know, and some of that comes home, Rick, to what you and I do. And that is trying to be an opposing and sane voice, counterbalancing, you know, all of the. I think at one point we saw statistics that for every 10 hours of liberal talk, there's, you know, 1,000 or more of right wing palaver out there. How do I put this? Do you have any metric of knowing, you go home at the end of the day, at the end of your show, and you feel like you fought the good fight? Do you get that sense that you're empowering people?
I have been recently. For a while, I thought I was just fighting in the wind, because no one would challenge me. And I encourage conservatives all the time to call in and challenge me on my thoughts, and they just don't. I have been getting considerable email contacts from people who say, you know, I've been listening for a while. Yeah, I wasn't sure how I felt, but, you know, more recently, I'm starting to get it. And I do. I think as people wake up to the reality that what they see on the corporate-controlled mainstream media is not always in their best interest. And that's one of the things that I talk about often. You know, our media in this country, 80% of everything we see, hear, and read are owned by about six multinational conglomerates. That's not good for democracy. When Rush Limbaugh is on 600-700 stations across this country, that is not good for democracy. When conservatives control the airwaves, that's not good for democracy. When there's not a free flow of ideas, that's not good. But here's the reality. Radio, like you know, Bob, is a business. You've got to sell advertising. And what do the big multinational corporations believe in? Weak unions, weak labor laws.
Low pay.
Low pay. So who are they going to support? A guy who's talking about the way to save work in this country, the way to save hard work in this country is through unions? Or are they going to say this? They're going to support a guy who says, well, we're all individuals and we can all make our own deals. You know where the ad money's going to go.
Oh, sure. And then that raises the second question then. And it's the eternal question that the horn faces, and I'm sure that you face. How do we convince the people on our side with whom we agree, with whom we have no grievance, whose fight, whose water we are carrying, that the Rick Smiths and the Bob Kincaids and the horns of the world deserve support? Because I've had some of those conversations, and I got to tell you, I come away from them awfully frustrated.
Yeah, and we're in the same, here again, you know, cut from the same cloth here, Bob. The reality is the people on our side honestly don't have the kind of resources that the other side has. So it's a matter of picking your battles for them. And, you know, I don't know if you know, but labor is under assault from every direction right now. Fortunately, you got Barack Obama in the White House, Hilda Solis, an excellent choice for labor secretary.
Bet she is.
Things are going to be a little easier on that front, but you're still fighting every day of the corporate battle. And once you figure out how to fund a progressive movement like the Olin Foundations and the Daniel Corses and the Nevinscapes have funded the conservative movement, let me know, because there aren't many George Soroses out there.
Well, and that's the other side of that coin. I know that we are severely underfunded, organizationally speaking, but the other battle that we fight is just to get our side to understand A, the validity, and B, the importance of this medium. You know, because
here's the thing, Bob, and this is kind of what frustrates me to no end. I am the only liberal voice in this listening area, and pretty much the whole center of the state of Pennsylvania. I am the only liberal voice, the only progressive voice. I'm it. There is not a station in this listening area who will put me on during the week for any amount of money. Not one station.
Yeah, you pay them, they won't do it.
Yep. Not one station. The big station here in the area, I offered them $100,000 an hour. They turned me down.
Oh, my God.
Because they have got... they have got such strong control. They have got the media by the throat, and they are strangling the life out of democracy. They know that they control the airwaves, which is why you're hearing the Brad O'Leary's of the world and the Roger Hedgecocks of the world going, oh, they're going to bring back the fairness doctrine.
Oh, doesn't that just make you just nuts?
I'm going, I don't hear anybody talking about that. I do hear people talking about local media ownership. I do hear going back and maybe undoing one of the worst bills Bill Clinton ever signed, the telecom bill of 96.
Yep.
I do hear talking about breaking up these huge conglomerates that own 1,200 radio stations across the country.
Yeah, because when you allow that to happen, the public airwaves that are no longer anything resembling public. They are the corporate airwaves.
You know, and until we take back the airwaves, you know, the conservatives, now that they control it, they don't want to give it up. Lee Scott over at Walmart said, you know, about the Employee Free Choice Act, we've been driving the car. We like driving the car. We're not going to give up the wheel. Well, the conservatives are saying the same thing about talk radio. We're driving the car. We like driving the car. We ain't giving up the wheel. And they're not without a fight. Here in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be talking to this Brad O'Leary about his crazy book, which is nothing more than 125 pages of stir up stupid people. Get all the people who don't think much, because it's only 125 pages, to get all those people up in arms because their ideology is such a failure. They need these radical wedge issues to keep themselves relevant. Because right now, I don't know if you've noticed, but the Republican Party is irrelevant. Their ideas have failed. Their policies are failures. I mean, there's a billboard here in the state. It says failure, 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 and then. Well, and then is failure for them. Everything they've done has been a failure. And I think, I got to tell you, there's a part of me that really, really believes that Barack Obama is going to save work in this country, and he is going to do what's in the best interest of the working people of this country, but it's not going to happen overnight. We didn't get here overnight. It's not going to be fixed overnight.
Oh, and you know what, Rick? We've spent considerable time talking about Arlen Specter, but the fact remains that Harry Reid does not have control of his own majority. I mean, when you're up against the wall with the, with Evan Bayh and Blanche Lincoln and David Pryor and Mary Landrieu, and Ben Nelson, Lord God, Billy Bob, Ben Nelson just makes me want to run around the yard screaming. Because you know there's no sense in talking about a 60th vote for EFCA when in fact we can't get to 54.
Yeah, you know I've often said to my conservative friends, if only I could con Tom DeLay into taking Harry Reid's spot. Say what you want about DeLay, and there's a lot to say. He knew how to keep people in line. If we could dig up President Johnson. Dig up Lyndon Johnson. We need somebody who can herd the cats, because right now the cats are running all over the place. We need somebody who can bring the party together and get them marching in the same direction. Right now, party's all over the place.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem like it should be that difficult, Rick. It's ugly. There's that old saying that the two things you never want to see made are hot dogs and laws. But you know, it's a matter of having the strength to haul some recalcitrant senator into your office and say, Fred, that hospital you wanted there in Podunk? No, yeah. Well, it ain't going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it'll happen when you vote the right way. You know, come to the cross.
At the end of it, though, isn't it about doing the right thing?
Yeah, it is.
It's going to be more about doing the right thing. And doesn't it say more about you and I and all the people listening to the program and to my program to get involved and to really get behind these politicians and say, look, this is what we want you to do. You know you want to do it. We're going to make you do it. And this is one of the things that Obama talked about. The election was one thing. But we need to stay active. We need to stay involved. I've got Specter's number on speed dial. I've got Bud Schuster's number, my congressman, Schuster. We got his number on speed dial. Granted, Schuster never votes the way I want him to, but at least he hears my voice. And that's what has to happen. We need more people to get involved. We need more people to tell these politicians what they should be doing. Don't let them off on their own, because they only get into trouble when they go off on their own.
Well, yeah, because they wander off into the dirty side of politics where all the nasty money is.
Right.
And terrible things happen there. And you know, I can't, I've talked about this a lot as well, Rick, and I can't emphasize enough how many times congressional, I've been in D.C. a couple of times lately, and how many times congressional staff have looked at me and said, you know, we love the emails, we like getting phone calls, but if you really, really want to get her attention, take the time to actually sit down and physically write a letter and put it in an envelope and stamp it and send it to us. It'll take a while getting here. But we know that if you took that kind of time, it really means something. Because, I mean, I had several of them say, our bosses hold those in their hands, and they know they have constituents that actually are taking time to care about an issue.
Spot on. Absolutely. And write letters to your editors, because they scour the local newspapers for anything with their name in it. Politicians don't like to see their names in negative print. They will take action when you've called them to the carpet.
Well, let's remind folks just a little bit. We of course play your show in delay on the weekend, but it's possible that Horn listeners might want to give you a call at some juncture. The live broadcast itself. Tell folks, please.
We're every Saturday and Sunday from noon to two. You can listen to the program from TheRickSmithShow.com. Click on Listen Live. It'll take you to our stream. Give us a call, 1-877-960-0960. All the information's right there on the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. I love getting phone calls from progressives because, for a while I wasn't thrilled with hearing people who just, you're right, Rick, right on. But there's something to that. That tells me that I've reached somebody.
Well, absolutely. And you know, we had 25 years of Rush Limbaugh. Magadetto's from Busted Knuckle, Rush. You're so dang smart. And, yeah, I want to be an individual American just like you. And that created a mindset that said that was the dominant viewpoint in America. There's got to be a little bit of hallelujah chorus.
Absolutely. But here's the thing. It's always nice to preach to the choir, but we need to make the choir a little bit bigger.
Make the choir bigger and get the choir going out singing on the corner.
Yep, and I think we're doing that, Bob. I got to tell you, I am generally a pessimist, but here these last couple of months I've been very optimistic. A lot has happened in these last 100 days. Some I'm not happy with, but for the most part, I think Obama's on the right track. I'm not fond of all the bailing out of all the welfare for corporations, but some of it you could say is a necessary evil. But we need to save work in this country. And I don't know if you've seen the last couple of bills that they're popping out, the one on credit cards and the one on 401ks. I think it's a step in the right direction.
Yes. And they're not. And those two bills in particular are not nearly as incremental as some of the other proposals that I've seen. They seem to have some decisiveness about them.
Okay. Well, because it's a right and wrong issue. I got to tell you, if you're paying your credit card bill every month, the credit card company should not be able to just jack your rates up to 30% whenever they feel like it willy-nilly.
Yeah, or because you were 15 seconds late with your phone bill.
Right. One of the things that bothers me about credit cards, and I got to tell you, between you, me, and the four walls, I think credit should be much more difficult to get than it is today. Because if it were, maybe we'd see our wages go up. I mean, there's been a beautiful manipulation in this country the last 40 years. I read something the other day. Listen to this. This is beautiful. For 150 years, from 1820 to 1970, wages went up every decade. Every decade, workers' wages went up, even during the Depression, because prices fell. Their standard of living got better every decade until we hit 1970, the middle 70s. Then it started going down, and it has been going down ever since. But corporate profits have gone up. So what do? They took all those corporate profits, they put them in the banks. What did the banks do? They lent you money with credit cards. So instead of seeing your wages go up, you saw your availability of credit go up. So the wages you should have been earning, you're not paying interest to a bank on. I mean, it's a beautiful scam. I don't even think the business leaders who dreamt this up ever thought it would work. But they figured out how to steal wages from working people and get them to pay interest on it on top of it. It's a beautiful thing if you're a business owner.
As the saying goes, nice work if you can get it.
Yeah, and this credit thing is another one of those same pieces of legislation going back to common sense. And that's really where we need to come back to, Bob. We've been too far out on the radical right, too far out on the business fringe. We need to come back to the middle, where working people live. I know so many people who are struggling to get by right now. And, to have governors like Sanford in South Carolina say, well, we're not going to take unemployment money because, we don't want to have to reform our system. Let those people suffer. It just angers me to no end.
It is infuriating. And I look for the day when labor can get serious and get, and I don't mean that they're not now, but get seriously back into organizing in the South. Because
I hope that's the truth. I hope they can do that. But here's the big thing, and I think this has to happen this year, and I think it's going to. There are a lot of very good signs. I think labor is going to come back together. I think the House of Labor will be reunited. This whole change the wind thing didn't work. It really hasn't. The split didn't do what it was.
It was a fight born of a battle of egos, and or at least that's the way I've read it. And no, it didn't work. Of course, you know, one of the good things that comes out of some of the stuff that's being proposed by Barack Obama, Rick, for instance, this high-speed rail initiative that was announced in the last week, those are all going to be prevailing wage jobs.
Yep.
And there is a massive rail program that goes right through the Southeast, and that's going to mean an opportunity to organize union building trades and union construction jobs right through the heart of the place that the Republican Party least wants them.
And you know what? You know why that's such an amazing step? Because here's what I really believe scares Republicans to no end. They don't want people to see government working. For so long, they've been the party of Reagan saying, well, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Or Grover Norquist, I want to drown government in the bathtub. They've made their living out of bashing government and beating our government down. They don't want to see it to work. They don't want to see anything positive come out of our government. They love failure. Like Rush Limbaugh said, I want him to fail. Because they know if people see our government working efficiently, smart, intelligently, and investing in our infrastructure and investing in this country, people are going to be more apt to what? Believe in government, which will make them even more obsolete. They understand that. My grandparents had a very positive view of government. Why? Because they lived through the Depression. They saw what government could do.
Government saved their lives.
Exactly. And we need to learn that again. We need to see through a politician who's going to do the right thing, spend money wisely, spend it efficiently, not allow somebody to fly a plane over the Statue of Liberty for $300,000+. We need somebody who's going to really pinch the pennies.
Well, it's not like working class people don't have to do that. So, you know, why shouldn't the rest of we don't get to do balance a monthly household budget. You know, we don't get to talk about deficits because the credit card companies don't tolerate them, and neither does the power company or the phone company or the cable company or any the water, the sewer, whatever. We have to deal with actual cash on hand, actual cash balance accounting. That our self-anointed betters have gotten away from. And it's time we sort of dragged them back to it.
I agree. But, you know, the credit card companies love when we're in debt. They love that 18% interest. They love that 20, 30% interest. You remember when they were fighting the bankruptcy battle, the bill battle? Bernie Sanders came out and said, well, I want to put cap usury rates at 30%. And the Republicans said, no. 30% is too low. There are no caps. They can charge whatever they want. I mean, they're charging interest rates that a mafia hitman would blush at.
Well, exactly. And the fact of the matter is, I had a statistic a year or so ago that indicates that fully in excess of a third of credit card company profits have nothing to do with the interest on the debt, but are rather made up of late fees, over-limit fees, and such as that.
Yep. And here again, coming back to this piece of legislation. Going to limit some of that. In fact, I talked to a local bank president here in the area this past weekend about this legislation. He said, you know what? The banks are going to lose over $10 billion once this legislation goes through. And you know what I said? Good. That means that $10 billion that they didn't steal from some working class guy because they held his bill in a mailbox for an extra day to charge him $39. And then double charge him on interest. Good, I'm happy about that. Now they'll have to go bilk money out of some wealthy investor.
Hear, hear. Rick Smith, thank you for all the time this evening. I really appreciate your input on Arlen Specter, as well as the rest of the topics over which we have ranged. I've sincerely enjoyed it, and look forward to the show every weekend. And know that you're welcome here any old time. Okay.
Bob, I appreciate you taking time for me. I thank you for putting our show on your station there. I'm getting some good feedback, and I appreciate everything you do for us. Thank you.
Well, you have a great evening, and we'll keep fighting the fight and check back in, okay?
All right, Bob Kincaid. Thank you so much, man.
All right, take care, Rick. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Rick Smith, he of the Rick Smith Show from Central Pennsylvania, comes your way about 5:30 on the first run for the Saturday show Eastern Time, as well as the Sunday show working in the rotation as well. Of course, if you want to check him out live, noon to 2, go to thericksmithshow.com and listen to the live stream there, and you can even call in if you've a yen to do so. I'm sure he'd love to hear from you. So it's about 5 minutes after 8, and we will take a little break and come back. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn, Activist Radio, and Hour 3 will begin presently.
tell them you're sick. You better have a bad cough. Because if you don't, well, that's just a way to know you are. What you gonna do with a welfare time?
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
11 minutes past the third hour of the program, the final hour, as B-Rez notes there. And once again, an evening that has simply flown by. Thanks to Rick Smith again for taking time for that conversation. He is a working guy, and that's time that he took away from his family or from much-needed rest to share with us. And I value that highly and appreciate it sincerely. As you know, President Barack Obama is speaking at the moment, offering some comments and reflections this evening. Certainly is making himself much more available than, shall we say, his predecessor did. Oh, got to stop the music first, Bob. Let's check in.
That I think we need to take right now. But understand that because this is a new strain, we have to be cautious. If this was a strain that we were familiar with,
obviously
then,
the
we might have to
flu issue.
Then I think we wouldn't see the kind of alert levels that we're seeing, for example, with the World Health Organization. Okay. Deb Price of Detroit News. Where's Deb? It's good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Let me speak to Chrysler first because the clock is ticking on Chrysler coming up with a plan. I am actually very hopeful, more hopeful than I was 30 days ago, that we can see a resolution that maintains a viable Chrysler auto company out there. What we've seen is the unions have made enormous sacrifices on top of sacrifices that they had previously made. You've now seen the major debt holders come up with a set of potential concessions that they can live with. All that promises the possibility that you can get a Fiat Chrysler merger and that you have an ongoing concern. The details have not yet been finalized, so I don't want to jump the gun, but I'm feeling more optimistic than I was about the possibilities of that getting done. With respect to GM, we're going to have another 30 days. They're still in the process of presenting us with their plans. But I've always said that GM has a lot of good product there, and if they can get through these difficult times and engage in some of the very difficult choices that they've already made, that they can emerge a strong, competitive, viable company. And that's my goal in this whole process. I would love to get the U.S. government out of the auto business as quickly as possible. We have a circumstance in which a bad recession compounded some great weaknesses already in the auto industry, and it was my obligation and continues to be my obligation to make sure that any taxpayer dollars that are in place to support the auto industry are aimed not at short-term fixes that continue these companies as wards of the state, but rather institutes the kind of restructuring that allows them to be strongly competitive in the future.
Will you pardon me an interjection here just for a second to note that every word he has just been has just spoken for the last 2 minutes is inconceivable to have come from the mouth of a former DIM leader. I know I got issues with the guy, but dadgum, it's nice to hear somebody who can verbalize an idea whether I agree with it or not.
They're going to have to use it. The fact that the major debt holders appear ready to make concessions means that even if they ended up having to go through some sort of bankruptcy, it would be a very quick type of bankruptcy, and they could continue operating and emerge on the other side in a much stronger position. So my goal is to make sure that we've got a strong, viable, competitive auto industry. I think some tough choices are being made. There's no denying that there's significant hardship involved, particularly for the workers and the families in these communities, and we're going to be coming behind whatever plan is in place to make sure that the federal government is providing as much assistance as we have to ensure that people are landing back on their feet, even as we strengthen these core businesses. Jake. Where's Jake? There he is.
You said in the past that waterboarding is a movement of torture. Torture is a way to diminish from the DAP dimensions. Do you believe that the previous administration sanctioned torture?
What I said, and I will repeat, is that waterboarding violates our ideals and our values. I do believe that it is torture. I don't think that's just my opinion. That's the opinion of many who examine the topic. And that's why I put an end to these practices. I am absolutely convinced it was the right thing to do. Not because there might not have been information that was yielded by these various detainees who were subjected to this treatment, but because we could have gotten this information in other ways, in ways that were consistent with our values, in ways that were consistent with who we are. I was struck by an article that I was reading the other day talking about the fact that the British, during World War II, when London was being bombed to smithereens, had 200 or so detainees. And Churchill said, "We don't torture." When the entire British, all of the British people were being subjected to unimaginable risk and threat. And the reason was that Churchill understood you start taking shortcuts, and over time, that corrodes what's best in a people. It corrodes the character of a country. And so I strongly believe that the steps that we've taken to prevent these kinds of enhanced interrogation techniques will make us stronger over the long term and make us safer over the long term, because it will put us in a position where we can still get information. In some cases, it may be harder, but part of what makes us, I think, still a beacon to the world is that we are willing to hold true to our ideals even when it's hard, not just when it's easy. At the same time, it takes away a critical recruitment tool that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations have used to try to demonize the United States and justify the killing of civilians. And it makes us, it puts us in a much stronger position to work with our allies in the kind of international coordinated intelligence activity that can shut down these networks. So this is a decision that I am very comfortable with, and I think the American people over time will recognize that It is better for us to stick to who we are, even when we're taking on a unscrupulous enemy. Okay. I'm sorry. I believe that waterboarding was torture, and I think that the whatever legal rationales were used, it was a mistake. Mark Nolan.
Thank you, sir. Let me follow up, if I may, on Jake's question.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read the documents recently referred to by former Vice President Cheney and others saying that the use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques not only protected the nation but saved lives?
Yeah, listen to Mark Noller.
Part of the United
carrying
States
water for
under imminent threat.
Big time
dick. Do you envision yourself ever authorizing the use of those enhanced interrogation techniques?
I have read the documents. Now, they haven't been officially declassified and released, and so I don't want to go into the details of them. Here's what I can tell you, that the public reports and the public justifications for these techniques, which is that we got information from these individuals that were subjected to these techniques, doesn't answer the core question, which is, could we have gotten that same information without resorting to these techniques?
You mean we finally got the information on waterboarding number 183 that we couldn't get on 180 through 182? Get up, come
so
on, I don't buy it.
When I made the decision to release these memos, and when I made the decision to bar these practices, this was based on consultation with my entire national security team, and based on my understanding that ultimately I will be judged as commander-in-chief on how safe I'm keeping the American people. That's the responsibility I wake up with, and it's a responsibility I go to sleep with. And so I will do whatever is required to keep the American people safe. But I am absolutely convinced that the best way I can do that is to make sure that we are not taking shortcuts that undermine who we are. There have been no circumstances during the course of this first 100 days in which I have seen information that would make me second guess the decision that I've made. Okay. Chuck Todd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I want to move to Pakistan. Pakistan appears to be at war with the Taliban.
And we wish you would, Chuck, you member of the for-profit media.
Can you reassure the American people that, if necessary, America could secure Pakistan's nuclear arsenal and keep it from getting into the Taliban's hands or, worst-case scenario, even Al-Qaeda's hands?
I'm confident that we can make sure that Pakistan's nuclear arsenal is secure. Primarily, initially, because the Pakistani army, I think, recognizes the hazards of those weapons falling into the wrong hands. We've got strong military-to-military consultation and cooperation. I am gravely concerned about the situation in Pakistan, not because I think that they're immediately going to be overrun and the Taliban would take over in Pakistan, more concerned that the civilian government there right now is very fragile and don't seem to have the capacity to deliver basic services, schools, health care, rule of law, a judicial system that works for the majority of people. And so as a consequence, it is very difficult for them to gain the support and the loyalty of their people. So we need to help Pakistan, help Pakistanis. And I think that there's a recognition increasingly on the part of both the civilian government there and the army that that is their biggest weakness. On the military side, you're starting to see some recognition just in the last few days that The obsession with India as the mortal threat to Pakistan has been misguided, and that their biggest threat right now comes internally. And you're starting to see the Pakistani military take much more seriously the armed threat from militant extremists. We want to continue to encourage Pakistan to move in that direction. And we will provide them all the cooperation that we can. We want to respect their sovereignty, but we also recognize that we have huge strategic interests, huge national security interests in making sure that Pakistan is stable and that you don't end up having a nuclear-armed militant state.
But in the worst-case
scenario, I'm not going to engage.
The U.S. military could secure this nuclear.
I'm not going to engage in hypotheticals of that sort. I feel confident that that nuclear arsenal will remain out of militant hands. Okay. Jeff Mason.
Thank you, Mr. President. One of the biggest changes you've made in the first 100 days regarding foreign policy has had to do with Iraq. But due to the large-scale violence there right now, does that affect the U.S. strategy at all for withdrawal, and could it affect the timetable that you've set out for troops?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that although you've seen some spectacular bombings in Iraq that are a legitimate cause of concern, civilian deaths, incidents of bombings, et cetera, remain very low relative to what was going on last year, for example. And so you haven't seen the kinds of huge spikes that you were seeing for a time. The political system is holding and functioning in Iraq. Part of the reason why I called for a gradual withdrawal as opposed to a precipitous one was precisely because more work needs to be done on the political side to further isolate whatever remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq still exist. And I'm very confident that with our commander on the ground, General Odierno, with Chris Hill, our new ambassador, having been approved and already getting his team in place, that they are going to be able to work effectively with the Maliki government to create the conditions for an ultimate transfer after the national elections. But there's some serious work to do on making sure that how they divvy up oil revenues is ultimately settled, what the provincial powers are and boundaries, the relationship between the Kurds and the central government, the relationship between the Shia and the Kurds. Are they incorporating effectively Sunnis, Sons of Iraq, into the structure of the armed forces in a way that's equitable and just? Those are all issues that have not been settled the way they need to be settled. And what we've done is we've provided sufficient time for them to get that work done, but we've got to keep the pressure up, not just on the military side, but on the diplomatic and development sides as well. Chip Reed.
Thank you, Mr. President. On Senator Specter's switch to the Democratic Party, you said you were thrilled. I guess nobody should be surprised about that. But how big a deal is this, really? Some Republicans say it is huge. They believe it's a game changer. They say that if you get the 60 votes in the Senate, that you will be able to ride roughshod over any opposition, and that we're on the verge of, as one Republican put it, one-party rule. Do you see it that way? And also, what do you think his switch says about the state of the Republican Party?
Well, first of all, I think very highly of Arlen Specter. I think he's got a record of legislative accomplishment that is as good as any member of the Senate. And I think he's always had a strong independence streak. I think that was true when he was a Republican. I think that will be true when he's a Democrat. He was very blunt in saying I couldn't count on him to march lockstep on every single issue. And so he's going to still have strong opinions, as many Democrats in the Senate do. I've been there. It turns out all the senators have very strong opinions. And I don't think that's going to change. I do think that having Arlen Specter in the Democratic caucus will liberate him to cooperate on critical issues like health care, like infrastructure and job creation, areas where his inclinations were to work with us, but he was feeling pressure not to. And I think the vote on the Recovery Act was a classic example. Ultimately, he thought that was the right thing to do, and he was fiercely berated within his own party at the time for having taken what I considered to be a very sensible step. So I think it's overall a positive. Now, I am under no illusions that suddenly I'm going to have a rubber stamp Senate. I've got Democrats who don't agree with me on everything. And that's how it should be. Congress is a co-equal branch of government. Every senator who's there, whether I agree with them or disagree with them, I think truly believes that they are doing their absolute best to represent their constituencies. And we've got regional differences, and we've got some parts of the country that are affected differently by certain policies. Those have to be respected, and there's going to have to be compromise and give and take on all of these issues. I do think that, to my Republican friends, I want them to realize that me reaching out to them has been genuine. I can't sort of define bipartisanship as simply being willing to accept certain theories of theirs that we tried for 8 years and didn't work, and the American people voted to change. But there are a whole host of areas where we can work together. And I've said this to people like Mitch McConnell. I said, look, on health care reform, you may not agree with me that we should have a public plan. That may be philosophically just too much for you to swallow. On the other hand, there's some areas like reducing the cost of medical malpractice insurance where you do agree with me. If I'm taking some of your ideas and giving you credit for good ideas, the fact that you didn't get 100% can't be a reason every single time to oppose my position. And if that is how bipartisanship is defined, a situation in which basically wherever there are philosophical differences, I have to simply go along with ideas that have been rejected by the American people in a historic election, we're probably not going to make progress. If, on the other hand, the definition is that we're open to each other's ideas, there are going to be some differences, the majority will probably be determinative when it comes
to... God, I wish he was right.
Just hardcore differences that we can't resolve, but there's a whole...
Somebody's going to tell him you can't talk to these freaks.
Together, then I think we can make progress.
Is the Republican Party in the desperate straits that Arlen Specter seems to think it is?
You know, politics in America changes very quick. And I'm a big believer that things are never as good as they seem and never as bad as they seem. You're talking to a guy who was 30 points down in the polls during a primary in Iowa. So I don't believe in crystal balls. I do think that our administration has taken some steps that have restored confidence in the American people that we're moving in the right direction, and that simply opposing our approach on every front is probably not a good political strategy. Okay. Ed Henry.
Thank you, Mr. President. In a couple of weeks, you're going to be giving the commencement at Notre Dame. And as you know, this has caused a lot of controversy.
Dear Lord, you just knew that Ed Henry would come up with something like... Yeah, the last time. Your friends on the left.
First things you wanted to do was...
An abortion question. America's going down the toilet, and he's got an abortion question. Hey, note to CNN. Can you not do better? Give me a call. I'll ask at least a relevant question.
Now that you've been president for 100 days... obviously, your pay grade is a little higher than when you were a senator. Do you still hope that Congress quickly sends you the Freedom of Choice Act so you can sign it?
You know, the my view on abortion, I think, has been very consistent. I think abortion is a moral issue and an ethical issue. I think that those who are pro-choice make a mistake when they... if they suggest, and I don't want to create straw men here, but I think there's some who suggest that This is simply an issue about women's freedom and that there's no other considerations. I think, look, this is an issue that people have to wrestle with and families and individual women have to wrestle with. The reason I'm pro-choice is because I don't think women take that that position casually. I think that they struggle with these decisions each and every day, and I think they are in a better position to make these decisions ultimately than...
Than some pasty-faced, doughy white guy, Mr. President? Yes, you're right.
Or a president of the United States, in consultation with their families, with their doctors, with their clergy. So that's been my consistent position. The other thing that I said consistently during the campaign is I would like to reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies that result in women feeling compelled to get an abortion or at least considering getting an abortion, particularly if we can reduce the number of teen pregnancies, which has started to spike up again. And so I've got a task force within the Domestic Policy Council in the West Wing of the White House that is working with groups both in the pro-choice camp and in the pro-life camp to see if we can arrive at some consensus on that. Now, the Freedom of Choice Act is not my highest legislative priority. I believe that women should have the right to choose, but I think that the most important thing we can do to tamp down some of the anger surrounding this issue is to focus on those areas that we can agree on. And that's where I'm going to focus. Mm-hmm. Jeff Zellman.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mm-hmm. During these first 100 days, what has surprised you the most about this office, enchanted you the most about serving in this office, humbled you the most, and troubled you the most?
Now, let me write this down.
Surprised, troubled.
I've got, what was the first one?
Surprised. Troubled.
Troubled.
Enchanted.
Enchanted.
Nice. And humbled.
And what was the last one?
Humbled. Humbled. Thank you, sir.
All right. Okay. Surprised. I am surprised compared to where I started when we first announced for this race by the number of critical issues that appear to be coming to a head all at the same time. You know, when I first started this race, Iraq was a central issue, but the economy appeared on the surface to still be relatively strong. There were underlying problems that I was seeing with health care for families and our education system and college affordability and so forth, but obviously I didn't anticipate the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. You know, the typical president, I think, has two or three big problems. We've got seven or eight big problems. And so we've had to move very quickly. I'm very proud of my team for the fact that we've been able to keep our commitments to the American people to bring about change while at the same time managing a whole host of issues that had come up that weren't necessarily envisioned a year and a half ago. Troubled. I'd say less troubled, but sobered by the fact that change in Washington comes slow. That there is still a certain quotient of political posturing and bickering that takes place even when we're in the middle of really big crises. I would like to think that everybody would say, you know what, let's take a time out on some of the political games focus our attention for at least this year, and then we can start running for something next year. And that hasn't happened as much as I would have liked. Enchanted? Enchanted. I will tell you that when I meet our servicemen and women, enchanted is probably not the word I would use. but I am so profoundly impressed and grateful to them for what they do. They're really good at their job. They are willing to make extraordinary sacrifices on our behalf. They do so without complaint. They are fiercely loyal to this country. And, you know, the more I interact with our servicemen and women, from the top brass down to the lowliest private, I'm grateful to them. Humbled by the fact that the presidency is extraordinarily powerful, but we are just part of a much broader tapestry of American life, and there are a lot of different power centers. And so I can't just press a button and suddenly have the bankers do exactly what I want. Turn on a switch and suddenly, Congress falls in line. And so, you know, what you do is to make your best arguments, listen hard to what other people have to say, and coax folks in the right direction. This metaphor has been used before, but the ship of state is an ocean liner. It's not a speedboat. And so the way we are constantly thinking about this issue of how to bring about the changes that the American people need is to say, if we can move this big battleship a few degrees in a different direction, you may not see all the consequences of that change a week from now or 3 months from now, but 10 years from now or 20 years from now, our kids will be able to look back and say, that was when we started getting serious about clean energy. That's when healthcare started to become more efficient and affordable.
No offense, Mr. President. We don't have that kind of time.
Serious about raising our standards in education.
On energy. We don't.
And so I have a much longer time horizon than I think you do when you're a candidate or if you're listening, I think, to...
Our horizon was significantly shortened, Mr. President, when your Department of Justice said that Appalachian people are not worthy of further review.
By the American people just say, who have shown extraordinary patience, and I think a recognition that we're not going to solve all these problems overnight. Okay? Lori Montenegro.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, when you met with the Hispanic caucus a few weeks ago, reports came out that the White House was planning to have a forum to talk about immigration and bring it to the forefront. Going forward, my question is, what is your strategy to try to have immigration reform, and are you still on the same timetable to have it accomplished in the first year of your presidency? And also, I'd like to know if you're going to reach out to Senator John McCain, who is Republican and in the past has favored immigration reform.
Well, we reach out to Senator McCain on a whole host of issues. He has been a leader on immigration reform. I think he has had the right position on immigration reform, and I would love to partner with him and others on what is going to be a critical issue. We've also worked with Senator McCain on what I think is a terrific piece of legislation that he and Carl Levin have put together around procurement reform. We want that moved, and we're going to be working hard with them to get that accomplished. What I told the Congressional Hispanic Caucus is exactly what I said the very next day in a town hall meeting and what I will continue to say publicly, and that is we want to move this process. We can't continue with a broken immigration system. It's not good for anybody. It's not good for American workers. It's dangerous for Mexican would-be workers who are trying to cross a dangerous border. It is putting a strain on border communities who oftentimes have to deal with a host of undocumented workers, and it keeps those undocumented workers in the shadows, which means they can be exploited at the same time as they're depressing U.S. wages. So what I hope to happen is that we're able to convene a working group working with key legislators like Luis Gutierrez and Nidia Vasquez and others to start looking at a framework of how this legislation might be shaped. In the meantime, what we're trying to do is take some core, some key administrative steps to move the process along to lay the groundwork for legislation. Because the American people need some confidence that if we actually put a package together, we can execute. So Janet Napolitano, who has great knowledge of this because of having been a governor, she's already in the process of reviewing and figuring out how can we strengthen our border security in a much more significant way than we're doing. If the American people don't feel like you can secure the borders, then it's hard to strike a deal that would get people out of the shadows and on a pathway to citizenship who are already here, because the attitude of the average American is going to be, well, you're just going to have hundreds of thousands of more coming in each year. On the other hand, showing that there is a more thoughtful approach than just raids of a handful of workers, as opposed to, for example, taking seriously the violations of companies that sometimes are actively recruiting these workers to come in, that's, again, something that we can start doing administratively. So what we want to do is to show that we are competent and getting results around immigration, even on the structures that we already have in place, the laws that we already have in place, so that we're building confidence among the American people that we can actually follow through on whatever legislative approach emerges. Okay? I see the process moving this first year, and I'm going to be moving it as quickly as I can. I've been accused of doing too much. We are moving full steam ahead on all fronts. Ultimately, I don't have control of the legislative calendar, and so we're going to work with legislative leaders to see what we can do. Andre Scholl, there you go.
Thank you, Mr. President. As the entire nation tries to climb out of this deep recession, in communities of color, the circumstances are far worse. The black unemployment rate, as you know, is in the double digits. And in New York City, for example, the black unemployment rate for men is near 50%. My question tonight is, given this unique and desperate circumstance, what specific policies can you point to that will target these communities, and what's a timetable for us to see tangible results?
Well, keep in mind that every step we're taking is designed to help all people. But folks who are most vulnerable are most likely to be helped because they need the most help. So when we passed the Recovery Act, for example, and we put in place provisions that would extend unemployment insurance or allow you to keep your health insurance even if you've lost your job, that probably disproportionately impacted those communities that had lost their jobs. And unfortunately, the African-American community and the Latino community are probably overrepresented in those ranks. When we put in place additional dollars for community health centers to ensure that people are still getting the help that they need, or we expand health insurance to millions more children through the Children's Health Insurance Program. Again, those probably disproportionately impact African-American and Latino families simply because they're the ones who are most vulnerable. They've got higher rates of uninsured in their communities. So my general approach is that if the economy is strong, that will lift all boats, as long as it is also supported by, for example, strategies around college affordability and job training, tax cuts for working families as opposed to the wealthiest, that level the playing field and ensure bottom-up economic growth. And I'm confident that that will help the African American community live out the American dream at the same time as it's helping communities all across the country. Okay. Michael Scherer of Time.
Thank you, Mr. President. During the campaign, you criticized President Bush's use of the state secrets privilege, but U.S. attorneys have continued to argue the Bush position in three cases in court.
Ooh,
how
should
that
be good.
Your view of state secrets differ from President Bush's, and do you believe presidents should be able to derail entire lawsuits about warrantless wiretapping or rendition if classified information is involved?
I actually think that the state secret doctrine should be modified. I think right now it's overbroad. But keep in mind what happens is we come into office, we're in for a week, and suddenly we've got a court filing that's coming up. And so we don't have the time to effectively think through what exactly should a overarching reform of that doctrine take. We've got to respond to the immediate case in front of us. I think it is appropriate to say that there are going to be cases in which national security interests are genuinely at stake and that you can't litigate without revealing covert activities or classified information that would genuinely compromise our safety. But searching for ways to redact, to carve out certain cases, to see what can be done so that a judge in chambers can review information without it being an open court. There should be some additional tools so that it's not such a blunt instrument. And we're interested in pursuing that. I know that Eric Holder and Greg Craig, my White House counsel, and others are working on that as we speak. Jonathan Weissman, you get the last word. Where are you? There you are.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
You are currently the chief shareholder of a couple of very large mortgage giants. You are about to become the chief shareholder of a car company, probably two. I'm wondering, what kind of shareholder are you going to be? What is the government's role as the...
If you were a twee, what kind of twee would you be?
Public trusts and bonds in...
For-profit journalists.
...soon-to-be public companies again. Thank you.
Well, I think our first role should be shareholders that are looking to get out. I don't want to run auto companies. I don't want to run banks. I've got two wars I've got to run already. I've got more than enough to do. So the sooner we can get out of that business, the better off we're going to be. We are in unique circumstances. You had the potential collapse of the financial system, which would have decimated our economy. And so we had to step in. As I've said before, I don't agree with every decision that was made by the previous administration when it came to TARP, but the need for significant intervention was there, and it was appropriate that we moved in. With respect to the auto companies, I believe that America should have a functioning competitive auto industry. I don't think that taxpayers should simply attach an umbilical cord between the U.S. Treasury and the auto companies so that they are constantly getting subsidies. But I do think that helping them restructure at this unique period when sales, you know, the market has essentially gone from 14 million down to 9 million, I don't think that there's anything inappropriate about that. My goal on all this is to help these companies make some tough decisions based on realistic assumptions about economic growth, about their market share, about what that market's going to look like, to prevent systemic risk that would affect everybody. And as soon as their situations are stabilized and the economy is less fragile so that those systemic risks are diminished, to get out, find some private buyers. And
with that, we will close out on President Barack Obama's press conference. And, you know, all I can say is that after 8 years of dim leader, and he really is the standard by which you have to judge President Obama, 8 years of dim leader, one of these things, and God knows they were few enough, as it were, a dim leader press conference would leave you feeling like you had gorged yourself on marshmallows or cotton candy. You'd had a lot of it, but you didn't feel like you'd had anything. By comparison, what we just heard for the last hour is enough information that we may be the better part of tomorrow evening's program just digesting it all. You know, the explanation about invoking state secrets. You really can't argue with the apparent sincerity of President Obama. And you can't, it's tough to argue with the reason that he put forward. But still, there are holes. Without a doubt, there are holes. And we will talk about them. So that's the end of the program for this evening. Thank you to Peter Godbold, our IT professional, always keeping an eye on the computer world to make sure that the computers that make sure this program gets out to you are doing what they are supposed to do. To our chief engineer, webmaster, web designer, and talk host, musician, John Fox. There's no end to the talents that John Fox brings to this endeavor. Everything you hear comes as a by virtue of the efforts of Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org. Ben never sends a bill. He just leaves it up to the people who avail themselves of his efforts to make sure that he's able to continue them. The same, too, here at the Horn. April's almost over. Some of you have made absolutely heroic efforts, and our thanks go out to you to help us avoid some red ink on the month of April. Thank you. Thanks to Horn intern junior grade Ferg, who took your calls tonight, who is still trying to learn how not to talk when the boss's microphone is open. See? We're learning. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColRiverWind.org. You know how hard they work. Because, among other things, joined with your efforts, the Horn is still here. They stand and fight upstream for all of us, and it is all of us who are downstream and downwind. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America, and welcome to the Inside Scoop. Today, April 29th, 2009, is officially the 100th day of the Obama presidency. And, of course, all the media is out there making mincemeat of this arbitrary day. But you know what? It does give us a chance to see how the President of the United States has done out of the gate on this 100th day, 99 days and some 5 hours ago. Barack Obama was inaugurated as President of the United States. And I think it's fair to say, well, how's he started? How's his presidency began? Later on in this broadcast, I'm going to bring a member of Congress on the air to give his perspective, Russ Carnahan, a Democrat of Missouri, and we'll get to him later in the broadcast. But as I was writing down all the different things that I think Barack Obama will be remembered for in his first 100 days, the first thing that came to my mind was how many things this is.